come to the 13th presentation in this first of two series of 13. So this is a pivotal presentation. The next emphasis will be on the future, because Hermetic America is very much already, for a long time now, been in the future. But in order to appreciate the future, we have to have a resonant harmonic that is not the past, but is the new past. To be able to understand a presence which is the deepest, highest dimensions of the moment, that presence is not just a present. A present is a point where the past supposedly ends and the future from there begins. But to quote Omar Khayyam in the Rubaiyat, the moving hand of the pen moves on. To have a present moment in high meditation is called, the term is from Sanskrit because it's the first time that a language was able to give it a term. The term is bodhicitta. It means the thought of enlightenment from the seed of the moment. And in the high dharma, the present moment in its atomic structure has a 16-part matrix in the shape of a wheel. It is the Dharma Chakra wheel. But if one looks at the Dharma Chakra wheel, it has 8 spokes. So that one half of a atomic, subatomic structure of a time moment present has 8 discursive parts, but the other 8, the other half of that, never occur discursively and always occupy what in music would be called a trill, but in geometry is called a space, an interval. So the space between the spokes counts towards the entire structure of the wheel, but the 8 spaces made by the 8 spokes are actually not only a single space, but they are a single space that cannot be quantized outside of space in general. So that the 8 spokes occur in suspension, in a suspended infinite space. And those 8 spokes only occur because of a delegation of an axial hub of those 8 spokes and a defining rim of those 8 spokes. When you get down to the subatomic structure, not just subatomic, but the time is also subatomic. It's not just a nanosecond or picosecond or femtosecond, but attosecond. The time it takes for an atom to vibrate one beginning iota. And when that happens, it is not just the electron that moves in that vibration, but the proton also will have its vibratory motion. And that motion gives a time form to the structure, which allows for the rimming of it, the spoking of it, and the axial of it, so that in really high contemplation and meditation, the present vanishes. The whole point of Zen is that there is no point to the present. whatsoever. It is a continuity without form or limit. And because it is so, there is a quality to it of lingering resonance, which is more specifically able to be called presence. And presence, which we have been developing for a long time here, is shareable. Two entities can share a presence perfectly so that they are tuned like a tuning fork. And once tuned in that way, they can remember being tuned together no matter how disparate they were in the cosmos. This is called a quantum effect, and any pair of particles that were ever emerged together, no matter where they have gone in the cosmos, they will always be in tune and vibrate together. This is a 21st century quantum physics actuality. It's called entanglement. The shared presence tuning is capable of being remembered not as a thing in the memory, in the mind, but in the very continuity of remembering, braided with the flow of creative imagining. And that remembering process, flow, and that creative imagining flow occur together in a field which is a quintessential fifth dimension called differential consciousness. The future occurs out of that, and the new past occurs out of that in parenthetical ripples that can be understood and go together so that one can understand prophetically the future at the same time as to envision accurately the new past. They go together. It's like the two eyes for sight. And one has an insight into the future possibilities, and one has a foresight of how that will reconstitute a new past. So that this is an ancient Hermetic wisdom understanding, East and West. And the easiest way to give it a mental, symbolic, ordered formulation is in a triad. Triads are always the easiest for the symbolic mind to grasp. This is because of its mythic horizon origins, and the mythos always has a beginning, it has a middle, and it has an end. It's not that the beginning is just the original beginning, but it's the beginning of the story, of the myth, of the mythos. The extension is as much as one has told, and the end is that completes that particular story. And there are many stories that are available. So the mind symbolically will imagine quickest and remember longest in terms of triads. The Hermetic triad is alchemy, cosmology, and philosophy. The alchemy is the transform of existentials, of things, of the ritual actions that are taken as forms, like a karma. And the cosmology is the largest universe, the context. And philosophy is the bridge between the transforms that enrich the cosmos and the alchemy that enriches the world. And the love of wisdom is the bridging between the two. It's a bridging not of a present moment, but of presencing, which is shareable. so that the ancient saying from Plato, remembering he heard it from Socrates, and Socrates heard it from his teacher Diotima, and she heard it directly from Pythagoras, who was the first to call himself a philosopher, a lover of wisdom. Being a lover of wisdom is that one lives as a companion with those that you investigate with, that you inquire with. And so, in the deepest possible way, experience will have its flow, which can be enriched by a superior flow. And that superior flow is what we call experience, science. And that science begins with a visionary fifth dimension consciousness, which gives us then the possibilities that emerge as the future and the retrospective changes that happen to the past, and so you have a new past. And an example of that is this book that came out in 1958, Consciousness in Concord, Concord, New Hampshire, by the great Perry Miller, who was the great professor at Harvard at the time on American Studies. He's the one that found a lost notebook of Henry David Thoreau, the most particularly interesting notebook, that of the late 1840 year and the beginning of 1841, which was the pivotal emergence of Thoreau for the first time as a prismatic person resonant to the cosmos. An extraordinary year. And just an excerpt, a couple of excerpts from Thoreau's lost notebook surfaced for the first time as Consciousness in Concord in 1958. This came out exactly at the same time that the United States was able to put the first satellite, the Explorer, into orbit. Here's Thoreau, August 10th, 1840, a single line. Between the hills, as in a crucible, a gleaming flood of light undulates. These are alchemical words. August 12th, 1840. A brave soul will make peaceful times dangerous, and dangerous times peaceful. We strive to prolong our moments of comfort and leisure as if that were life and not a stagnation of life. Life is current and not stagnant and cannot afford to repeat a certain past cheapness to the sacrifice of a possible future affluence. He was about 20 years of age. When the accents of wisdom and eloquence have died away, I discover that the chirp of the crickets is still clear in advance. A good book will not be dropped by its author, but thrown up. It will be so long a promise that he will not overtake it soon. He will have slipped the leash of a fleet hound. When I hear a strain of music from across the street, I put away Homer and Shakespeare and read them in the original. Of course, Shakespeare wrote in English, but one has to understand that he wrote in very high Elizabethan English that was at the pinnacle of a transform of language. It was a transform of language out of a previous transform that Chaucer had performed 200 years before, and that's called Middle English. And that was a transform of the original language called Old English that goes back to the 600s AD. Shakespeare's transform would be transformed again in the age of revolution by Shelley and Coleridge, Wordsworth, Blake. And in the 20th century, it was transformed again by poets who do this, Yeats, T.S. Eliot, Wallace Stevens, etc., William Faulkner. And what is being presented here is a transform of those five transforms of English into a new time form ability to use a differential conscious field and a kaleidoscopic conscious flow to open up for us dimensions of reality that were previously the purview of only a select few, a self-select few, and shareable by very small communities. About 22 years after Thoreau would write in this way in his Consciousness in Concord, in another Massachusetts town, Amherst, Emily Dickinson, at age 32, wrote this poem in a little letter that she sent to her sister-in-law. And you have to understand that Emily Dickinson had re-established with her older brother behind her, had re-established the original Dickinson home called the Homestead, and that her sister-in-law lived across an open garden, it was full of pine and beech trees, like a little forested patch. And there was another house on the other side called the Evergreen. But they wrote letters back and forth for over 35 years because it was in the act of writing and reading that the full savor of the presence sharing occurred. This is a poem that Emily Dickinson included in a little letter to her sister-in-law and across the yard. The face I carry with me last when I go out of time to take my rank by in the West, that face will just be thine. I'll hand it to the angel. That, sir, was my degree. In kingdoms, you have heard the raised refer to, possibly. He'll take it, scan it, step aside, return with a crown, such a crown as Gabriel never capered at, and begged me to put it on. And then he'll turn me round and round to an admiring sky as one that bore her master's name, sufficient royalty. The next day, she sent another short poem in another letter. Could I then shut the door, lest my beseeching face at last rejected be of her? The mirror self is an ego. It is a sheen off the reflected identity. And as long as we keep the fluidity of the flow of experience, much less the kaleidoscopic flow of conscious history, we will not be limited to the frozen, stagnant mirror image that matches or mismatches with our identity projection. And so that moment, which is not only fleeting, but finally fictitious, will not register as a hook to snag us in and make us think we are great because the ego matches the identity, or damaged because that does not match the identity, that the temporary flow of what those images of ourselves are in experience, in mythic, horizontal process flow, will be aspects of interest which we can then observe with the equanimity of continuity and with the insight of future possibilities and with the retrospective wisdom of whole collections of other facets of ourself. This is an extraordinary difference between experience and experiment. One of the most profound Hermetic Americans was Edwin Hubble, for whom the Hubble Space Telescope is aptly named. Hubble, born in Kentucky and finally went to Chicago, to go to the University of Chicago. Edwin Hubble was a surprising athlete. He was a tough guy. He at one time thought of being a professional boxer. He coached a basketball team. He was 6'2" plus, and at that time, he was born in 1889. That was a tall man. His father wanted him to be a lawyer. You have to be able to make money, and you have to be able to defend yourself in this tough world. Hubble wanted to be an astronomer. And he was there at the University of Chicago at a time when the University of Chicago, under George Ellery Hale's direction, was one of the most interesting areas in the world for the new astronomy coming forth. The quality of it was such that Hale convinced the University of Chicago that his 12-inch handmade telescope was not big enough to do professional world-class astronomy, and that they needed a new place in a larger telescope. And the large telescope he had in mind was a 40-inch telescope, which could not be positioned in Chicago because of all of the light, and so was positioned on the coast of Lake Geneva in Williams Bay, Wisconsin. And this is a photograph of Einstein in 1921 at the Great Yerkes Observatory under the 40-inch reflector telescope. Still one of the largest reflector telescopes ever made. Hale loved the fact that this young undergrad, supposed to be a lawyer, loved astronomy. At the end of his 4 years at the University of Chicago, he invited him to come and join an even larger telescope that he'd had built on Mount Wilson, just outside of Los Angeles here, above Pasadena. It had a 100-inch telescope. It was the largest in the world for two generations. And that telescope had been built already in the early part of the 20th century. This is a photograph in 1910. And what you have here are scientific, Hermetic American, and guest Hermetic American geniuses. Hale is the second figure here. Next to him is John Muir, the founder of the Sierra Club. And the man to match the mountains. And on the very end over here is Andrew Carnegie, one of the greatest philanthropists in world history, who helped build the Mount Wilson and the Mount Palomar observatories, and who set up many foundations. He set up libraries all across the United States. In Pittsburgh, the Carnegie Foundation is one of the largest philanthropic centers in the world. And in Washington, D.C., the Carnegie Institute is still on the leading edge of scientific development and cosmology, as we will see in the next part of Hermetic America. The discovery of dark matter and dark energy was due to Vera Rubin, who for decades has been at the Carnegie Institution in Washington, D.C. Because of his proximity, because Mount Wilson and Palomar both were associated with Caltech, very often he was invited to speak in the Pasadena area and the Huntington Library Quarterly, Huntington Library being in San Marino, about a good half hour's walk from Caltech. And in the April 1939 issue of the Huntington Library Quarterly, it leads off with Edwin Hubble's Points of View, Experiment and Experience. And this was the commencement address for Caltech in June of 1938. And he says in here, Edwin Hubble, the urge for science itself is a value. As one aspect of the search for truth, science is a necessary place in any proper culture. This fact has not always been recognized. The old humanism enshrined in the classical education of the last century disregarded science. That education, as Berry described it, Frederick Berry, the scientific habit of thought from the late 20s, that education was not the study of the great world of nature, but the study of man alone. And the study of man, not as the product and plaything of nature, but as a free, immortal soul, and no longer a struggling, humble soul, working its blind way towards the light, but an ardent soul, whose thought was more interesting than his work, and whose love and play and dreams and songs were more important than his thoughts. Hubble says, writes, the student was made familiar with the finest creative efforts of the race. The goal was good breeding, primarily a moral criterion, one which embodied the highest ethical and aesthetic ideals of the pagan and Christian tradition. Those ideals we must always cherish. They are, however, ideals of worth and of conduct. They do not completely satisfy our needs. Today we strive for a larger view, whereas nearly half a century ago, Newton's Principia, in response to it, Alexander Pope wrote and admonished his contemporaries, know then thyself, presume not God to scan, the proper study of mankind is man. Hubble, we believe today that the proper study of mankind is the universe, of which man is a part. We must explore both the realm of science and the world of values, for we believe that wisdom without knowledge is futile, and we know that knowledge without wisdom is dangerous. And he goes on to exclaim, from a standpoint of someone who had revolutionized the entire cosmology of the world permanently, Hubble, as a young man, did not go immediately to Mount Wilson, did not accept Hale's invitation immediately because World War I had broken out. And when he finished his 4 years at Chicago, he signed up because he was always the tough guy. He was always the first one to take it on as a physical challenge, as a personal mission. And so he volunteered for service in Europe in World War I. Disappointing to him, by the time he got there, most of the conflict was over, but he stayed in uniform, became a major, and was there until he was released in 1919. Then he went to Mount Wilson. And when he went to Mount Wilson, he immediately began to have a churning within him that there was something in the blurry nebula in astronomy that called out to him. And within a couple of years, he was able, for the very first time, to find, through accurate observation, in one of the nebula, it is now designated the Andromeda galaxy, Messier 31, he found that there was a variable Cepheid star, and because the periodicity of a Cepheid star lets the distance be computed, how far away it is, Hubble painstakingly did the observations and the computing, and he found that that Cepheid star in Andromeda Nebula was 800,000 light years away. No way that it's in our galaxy. It was the first indication to him. And you have to understand that the indication was not done on a computer in a warm room. It was done at night, because you use the observatory at night, and because heat will distort the lenses, it was always cold. And because it was always cold, you had to be really tough and virile to be able to stand there every night, because you had to do it every night in order to keep the continuity. And the only breaks he would take were hot cocoa breaks and sometimes some biscuits. And after 3 years, in 1922, he was able finally to publish an earth-shaking paper that the Andromeda Nebula was a galaxy outside of our galaxy, and that it was very, very, very far away, impossibly far away. We know today that the Andromeda galaxy is 2.2 million light years away, and is a galactic structure as large as our own, the Milky Way, and has many satellite galaxies, like we have almost two dozen satellite galaxies of the Milky Way itself, the large and small Magellanic clouds, etc. And so he spent the rest of the 1920s refining the startling idea that galaxies are island universes. And not only that, but making a classification of the different types of them. And then finding that they were tied to a redshift distance, Hubble's law. And all of this finally came to a conclusion, temporary conclusion, in 1936. He published by Yale University Press, The Realm of the Nebulae, which set up a whole understanding that the cosmos was much larger, that the context of man was much larger than the world or the starry fields or the idea of a universe, that there were, by his count, by that time, several hundred thousand island universes, each as large as our own, and just beginning to count. He was invited and went to England. He had gone for 3 years to Queen's College, Oxford, doing some graduate work. And Oxford University Press in 1937, the year after Realm of the Nebula, the observational approach to cosmology. And he writes in here, "Nebulae as island universes, the family characteristics of nebulae. The nebulae were found to be members of a single homogeneous family. They are all of the same general order of intrinsic luminosity or candle power, and they exhibit a common pattern of rotational symmetry about dominating central nuclei. Although the structural forms vary widely, they fall naturally into an ordered sequence in which the fundamental pattern varies systematically from one end to the other." The pattern was a globule, bright, semi-spherical, called an elliptical zero galaxy. And then there were seven other levels, E1, E2, all the way to E7. And then they jumped to spirals. And the spirals had three different types, spiral A, spiral B, spiral C. And then there were barred spirals. Instead of having lots of arms, they would have two arms. And so those were SB1, A, SBC, SBB. That typology was finally revised at the end of Hubble's life, but was not able. He died of a sudden heart attack. He was in his car with his wife, Grace, driving home from Caltech. And he suddenly said to her, "Grace, you have to get me home. I have just had a stroke." And he held on until she pulled into the driveway of their house in Pasadena, and held on until she got him into the house. And he did this out of love and respect for her, not to have her have to break down in a moving car or in the car. And he died. He left notes that were put together, and in 1961, the Hubble Atlas of Galaxy was published by his friend and student, Alan Sandage. And this, in 1961, was enormously important because for the first time, it showed the typology of the real cosmology, that the real cosmology was being known and understood. And it was only 14 years later that this magnificent volume was published, simply called Galaxies. And Galaxies by Timothy Ferris was published by the Sierra Club. The link between a Thoreau and a John Muir and a Hale and Hubble, the link between the philosophy of observation and the cosmology by observing the universe, and the cosmic implications of being able to observe the observer, and the ability to see the ecology of the world, all tie together. And this is one of the bows that a Hermetic America series can retie for us. We do not live in a chaos. We live in a vibrating, expanding harmonic of bows, not knots. Let's take a break. This is an issue of Time from 1948, February 9th, 1948, and the caption on the cover, this is Edwin Hubble. The caption on the cover reads, "Will Palomar's 200-inch eye see an exploding universe?" Now, this is extraordinary, not only because it is the lead into the dedication of the Palomar Observatory, which was June 3rd, 1948, but this is a crucial time in Hermetic America. as we will see in the next series. By early 1948, it was apparent, though secretly, and kept under secret cover even till this day, that extraterrestrials had been encountered, that extraterrestrial craft had been put into research, and back engineering was already beginning. And it was at this time, in 1948, that the Secretary of Defense, James S. Forrestal, began to suffer a psychological trauma from a telepathic encounter with an extraterrestrial who had been injured and was under medical care at a secret facility. But it was also exactly at this time that the United States had made an enormous advance on rockets. World rocketry had received a jump in Germany in the Third Reich. And their secret base was on the Baltic Sea, Peenemünde. And they had developed a powerful series of rockets, the V1, but especially its improved version, the V2. And they had set up an industrial mass production of the V2 rocket, which was not just an experimental one or two or three or four prototypes, but they were producing thousands of them on an assembly line, had employed right at the very end of the Second World War in 1945, sending in a period of just months more than 2,000 V2s onto England, most of them onto the city of London. And we're very close to improving that V2 when the United States and the Soviet Union forces made a beeline to try to commandeer a number of these V2 rockets and to kidnap, literally, the engineers and the staff who made this possible, and the splitting by those two armed force takeovers of the German V2 establishment led to the space race. All of this was happening in 1945, when the atomic bombs were surfacing, and to put a rocket and an atomic symbol together is exactly what one finds when one looks at a volume from 1954, and you find on the equipment, you do not find an American flag, even though it is in an American research center, White Sands. The northern part of the White Sands was all about atomic bombs. The southern part of White Sands was all about rockets, improving the V2, which by 1948-49 had achieved a phenomenal refinement in just a few years, showing that it was a crash program, much like the Manhattan crash program that produced the atomic bomb. And On February 24th, 1949, exactly a year after this cover on Edwin Hubble and the appearance of a 200-inch telescope at Mount Palomar showing a quality of scientific advancement that was literally breathtaking, on February 24th, 1949, this is from the opening paragraph of a book called Worlds in Space by Martin Kaiden, published in New York in 1954. At 3:19 p.m., Mountain Standard Time, on February 24th, 1949, the empty shell of a giant V-2 rocket, which had blasted free of the Earth 5 minutes before, smashed into the New Mexico desert. A little more than 6 minutes after the V-2 shattered into wreckage, the shell of a second, smaller rocket plunged into the broiling sands of New Mexico. That second missile was a 16-foot steel sliver known as the WAC, W-A-C, Corporal. The rocket series had begun in 1946 with a series called the Privates and had been revised by 1948 into a refined presentation called the Corporals. And this WAC Corporal had rocketed upward at 5,100 miles per hour and set man's highest mark in the heavens, 1,300,000 feet above the Earth. That's 252 miles up. That's higher than the International Space Station. In February of 1949, it was Forrestal himself who canceled the program, canceled the refinements that were projected, because by this time, not only were the German engineers for the V-2, most noticeably under Werner von Braun, who was the head of it, but there were a great number of American rocket geniuses who were descendants of Robert Goddard's rocket experiments and American avionic technology and America's industrial power, which was several times what the Third Reich could have, even at its peak as an industrial power. And the United States was poised to have an orbital space capacity by 1950. All this was canceled secretly by Forrestal. The MX-774 program was completely cut out. And for the next 10 years, the United States was in a backwash of repeating over and over again things that had already been accomplished better in the Third Reich in Germany. It sounds reminiscent, and it is reminiscent, of the American moon program, which by 1972 was able to send pairs of men to the moon almost on a shuttle schedule. And we have not been back to the moon now for almost half a century. And the plan to go back to the moon is a whole generation away, using the same technology that was developed in the 1950s, 1960s. Someone is stopping on very high levels the ability for a maturing America to have its place historically and throwing it back into a mythological regression. Almost all of the problems that we have today are symptomatic of a single infectious plague. You cannot have a historical regression back to a mythology without creating a nightmare barbarism psychologically in the people, in the sociology of the culture, and a mange in its capacities to sustain civilization. This is the most serious issue before the planet because we are, in every respect, the point guard. Now, what happens with a point guard, in hermetic terms, is that all of the resonances will tend to go where the beginning went. And if you go into a regression, all of the energies will swirl like a whirlpool and devolve very rapidly. To reverse that, all of a sudden, is catastrophic because it does not produce a reversal, it produces a maelstrom. So that the whole emphasis of this particular series and the next one is to try to set up a lived context by which a return to reality can be envisioned and carried out, and historically have it register, not just as a reversal of the reversal, but as a catching up with the actuality in terms of an expanded vision, so that the theoretical field of differential consciousness has the dimensional amplitudes to be able to float, to suspend the entirety of what needs to be done, and that is to produce a very large population of men and women who are able to function in reality on an expanded way and not simply be cases that increasingly resemble the Night of the Living Dead. If one looks at current popular television shows like Lost, 40-some, 50-some people, plane wrecked on an island with all sorts of peculiarities and flashbacks and flash forwards and increasingly a maelstrom of almost impossibility that it could be understood or lived or continued with. That what is actually happening is worse than what one could imagine being bad happening. So that what is being delivered here is being delivered around a very small campfire so that it can be delivered completely and not be squelched, not be sabotaged. We have seen that there was a tremendous release 300 years ago of a new quality of mankind, and that it was presaged before then, to use a popular phrase, by the Renaissance. And that the Renaissance had awakened from a medieval dream. That the United States is a medieval America is without question now, rather than a hermetic America. Yet this was not the case in the 1940s, up until the 1940s, up until 1949. There was a hermetic America that was extremely viable. Even with the travails of the 1930s and the challenges of the 1940s, the American people were in tremendous shape, personally, sociologically, historically, were the magnet of the best in the world. The only people coming now are those coming to feast on the carcass. A medieval America is dismal. One doesn't have to take a little pilgrimage across the country to see this. Anywhere you go, anywhere you look, and at oneself, and at those around, and you can see, is a convalescent case of waiting for the end. One of the most powerful explosions in the early part of the 20th century in Hermetic America was the rise of science fiction. That was leading in a visionary way and following very closely upon the developments in astronomy, in cosmology, the developments in the alchemy of chemistry and biology, in the philosophy of understanding the pivotal way in which men and women made the future and the new past at the same time, being able to recalibrate. Part of the new past that Americans were making, like James Henry Breasted's A History of Egypt, published in 1905, and republished in a Bantam classic in 1964. A reshaping of the whole understanding of the origins of civilization, not starting with the Greeks, not being dominated by the Romans, but going back to Egypt and at the same time of going back to the beginnings in Mesopotamia, at the same time going back to the beginnings in Asia, in India, in China, the archaeological new past was coming resonantly with the burgeoning scientific push into the future. And American science fiction, about this time, received a tremendous boon with the writings of Edgar Rice Burroughs. Under the Moons of Mars was published first in serial magazine, Argosy, in 1912. And exactly at the same time that Edgar Rice Burroughs was writing about a fighting Virginian on Mars, he was creating an Englishman who had been raised by the most primordial of the hominids, by great apes, not raised by human parents, Tarzan, Tarzan of the Apes. And that Tarzan, if you read the original first Tarzan, could not speak because the apes, his ape mother, his ape siblings, did not speak. He did not speak. He could not speak. And yet, because he had an innate, primordial, Paleolithic intelligence, he accidentally discovered the treehouse that his dead father had built for his now dead mother to try to survive a plane crash, and that they had left all sorts of indications for their son, and that Lord Greystoke left also ways in which, if anything were found, what could be recreated was the true context of the boy. And it was the teenage Tarzan who found the place, got in, discovered how to read, but could not yet speak because there was no one to talk to, but taught himself how to read. And with that came the beginnings of a contemplative amplitude which allowed him to understand the primordiality of life in such a way that he spanned everything from the apes to the English Lord Gentleman in one person, in one personal prism. towards the end of that first Tarzan novel, after he had met a Frenchman, a French pilot, and had learned to speak French. Was one of the first languages he learned to actually speak was Francaise. He was going with the captain back to Paris, back to try to find what civilization was like, to explore that. And they were in French West Africa at a bar. And there was a big argument among these hunters that the topic came up about lions being the king of the jungle. And Tarzan said, no, man is king of the jungle. And so he was challenged to this drunk bet that this is alcohol talking. So Tarzan stepped back, and like later comic book versions of Superman, he took off his gentleman's clothes and took his old hunting knife and in his skivvies, went out into the jungle, found and killed a lion, and toted it back and threw it into the bar to collect the bet. John Carter on Mars and Under the Moons of Mars, and it was called, when it was published as a book, A Princess of Mars, because there was an eternal romance here, a Martian princess, Deja Thoris is her name. But in order to manufacture the ability for this fighting Virginian to become like a prince of Mars so that he was worthy of her, the illustration showed him learning the ancient Martian wisdom as well, and learning from her the whole layout of the civilized Martians of the planet, and then finally proving himself to be the greatest warrior on Mars, because he had an Earthman's muscles. On Mars, he could leap 50 feet into the air. He was faster, he was stronger than any of them, even though the Thargs were very large, about 12 feet. He was the toughest, swiftest man. He became really the prince of Mars. This quality infused American science fiction and into the early 40s, you began to find a woman who outdid Edgar Rice Burroughs on Mars, Leigh Brackett. And Leigh Brackett's stories largely featured in Planet Stories. The Beast Jewel of Mars could fund beautiful and base bewitch the tall swordsman from Terra, a novel of lost worlds by Leigh Brackett. Other issues, Queen of the Martian Catacombs by Leigh Brackett. Sea Kings of Mars by Leigh Brackett. Lost Citadels of the Ages, a complete short novel by Leigh Brackett. The Lake of Gone Forever by Leigh Brackett. And Lorelei of the Red Mist, the first time that Ray Bradbury was published, because they were friends. She was the mentor of Ray Bradbury. And we have, due to research, a photo taken in the Tijuana bar. Here's the young Leigh Brackett. Her husband, Edmund Hamilton, one of the great swashbuckling science fiction writers, and Ray Bradbury, and Hamilton's sister, in the Tijuana bar. And sitting further outside the picture in another photo, two of the great writers, C.L. Moore and Henry Kuttner. You have here five of the greatest science fiction writers of the Golden Age, drinking and smoking and chumming in the Tijuana bar What is extraordinary about Lee Brackett was that she was a superior writer and was tapped by Howard Hawks to write the screenplay of The Big Sleep with William Faulkner in 1944. It was put out in 1946, but it was written in 44. The quality of her writing led Hawks to tap her in the late 1950s, and she wrote one of the great classic screenplays, Rio Bravo, and was so successful that she did a version of it by taking the cast of characters in the plot and showing a scintillation of it so it was the same jewel but from different angles, and it was El Dorado. And then she did it again to make a trilogy, the same kinds of characters, the same cast, in a very similar plot, but this time worked a different way. It was called Rio Lobo. 1970, 1958. So in 12 years, she did this trilogy. And at the same time, because she got interested in the way in which Hawks would do not only Westerns and mysteries, but she wanted to travel. She was born in Los Angeles, grew up in Los Angeles, had kind of a local life. She went with him to Africa to do the screenplay for the film Hatari, again starring John Wayne. And finally, the old Lee Brackett was tapped by George Lucas, and her last screenplay was for The Empire Strikes Back. Hermetic America is about extraordinary people who are able to reach into a visionary field and pull primordiality of both the future and the new past, and a sense of presencing, which is shareable. And this leads to extraordinary results. While Hubble was doing his monumental work in the early 1920s, all of a sudden, his discovery that there was a Cepheid variable star 800,000 light years away in one of the nebulae led his mentor and friend, George Ellery Hale, in 1923 to publish this little book called The New Heavens, published by Scribner's and Sons, that had done the history of Egypt by Breasted. At that time, Scribner's was one of the great publishers. They published a lot of Hemingway and so forth. The New Heavens, and there is constellation of Orion with a Hubble photograph. And the very next year, in 1924, The Depths of the Universe by George Ellery Hale. So that things were progressing rapidly year by year, and the frontispiece was the Horse's Head Nebula in Orion. And in 1926, the third in the series, Beyond the Milky Way. It was apparent that we lived in not only a wider, but a new universe. And this Horse's Head Nebula in Orion became one of the most famous photographs and photographable astronomical sites until the Hubble Space Telescope took this photo. These are columns of gas birthing stars, and these are dozens and dozens of light years high, and the little bits, the globules that are coming out, are proto-suns, and when they release themselves, they break away like into pear-shaped condensing, and they become stars. So this is a stellar nursery of hundreds of thousands of stars. And this is from the volume Hubble, A New Window on the Universe, and it was revisited. And the pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope became more and more refined until one had one of the most extraordinary photos ever taken. It was difficult to get time on the Hubble, and yet there was built into it discretionary time. And finally, 10 days were set aside to take one single shot. The Hubble telescope aimed at the Big Dipper and the star that links the bowl to the handle. Just above that star was a blank patch of nighttime sky. So they focused on a patch that was 1/30th the size of the full moon and let it run for 10 days and came up with the Hubble Deep shot. There are hundreds of thousands of galaxies of stars and planets and moons in that small patch of blank sky. How big is the cosmos? Our sense of cosmology now is so far beyond what it had been that you begin to have books like this come out. Origins, Our Place in the Hubble Universe. We are going back to originality, but not just originality in the cosmos, of finding the farthest limits of it, of finding the beginning seed of it, but the future and the new past of ourselves, of our shareable presence, is reawakening the entire series of harmonics, not only of our species, but of the origins of our species, going back to the origins of life. Not just life on this planet or in this star system. Our star system is less than 5 billion years old. The cosmos was almost 10 billion years old before our whole star system became a pear-shaped glob of gas and started forming the stellar system. As long as our star system has been here, the cosmos has had star systems twice as long as we have in our totality. This changes the way in which we understand ourselves. And Ray Bradbury was extraordinary. In one of these pulp science fiction magazines, this issue of Planet Stories, appeared a short story by him called The Million Year Picnic. And it was later incorporated as the last part of the Martian Chronicles, published in 1950. This is my copy that Ray signed for me at the Claremont Hotel in Berkeley for the 1968 World Science Fiction Convention. I gave the story in a previous presentation of how he came in late, and there were only about a dozen of us still standing and sober in the Claremont bar. And then came Ray with his little tape recorder satchel of his screenplay, Leviathan 99, turning his script of Moby Dick into a science fiction far-flung epic, and he played it for us. It was recorded in Britain. Here is the ending of The Million Year Picnic and The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury. In The Martian Chronicles, the Earth has blown itself up through nuclear war. He dropped a leaf in the fire. I'm burning a way of life, just like that way of life is being burned clean of the earth right now. Forgive me if I talk like a politician. I am, after all, a former state governor, and I was honest, and they hated me for it. Life on Earth never settled down to doing anything very good. Life, science ran too far ahead of us too quickly. And people got lost in a mechanical wilderness, like children making over pretty things, gadgets, helicopters, rockets, emphasizing the wrong items, emphasizing machines instead of how to run the machines. Wars got bigger and bigger and finally killed Earth. That's what the silent radio means. That's what we ran away from. We were lucky. There aren't any more rockets left. It's time you knew this isn't a fishing trip at all. I put off telling you, Earth is gone. Interplanetary travel won't be back for centuries, maybe never. But that way of life proved itself wrong and strangled itself with its own hands. You're young. I'll tell you this again every day until it sinks in. He paused to feed more papers to the fire. Now we're alone. We're we and a handful of others who'll land in a few days. Enough to start over. Enough to turn away from all that back on Earth and strike out on a new line. The fire leaped up to emphasize his talking. And then all the papers were gone except one. All the laws and beliefs of Earth were burnt into small hot ashes, which soon would be carried off in a wind. Timothy looked at the last thing that Dad tossed in the fire. It was a map of the world. And it wrinkled and distorted itself hotly and went flimpf and was gone like a warm black butterfly. Timothy turned away. Now I'm going to show you the Martians, said Dad. Come on, all of you. Here, Alice. He took her hand. Michael was crying loudly, and Dad picked him up and carried him, and they walked down through the ruins towards the canal. The canal. Where tomorrow or the next day their future wives would come up in a boat, small laughing girls now with their father and mother. The night came down around them, and there were stars. But Timothy couldn't find Earth. It had already set. That was something to think about. A night bird called among the ruins as they walked. Dad said, your mother and I will try to teach you. Perhaps we'll fail. I hope not. We've had a good lot to see and learn from. We planned this trip years ago before you were born. Even if there hadn't been a war, we would have come to Mars, I think, to live out and form our own standard of living, and it would have been another century before Mars would have really been poisoned by Earth's civilization. Now, of course, they reached the canal. It was long and straight and cool and wet and reflective in the night. I've always wanted to see a Martian, said Michael. Where are they, Dad? You promised. There they are, said Dad, and he shifted Michael on his shoulder and pointed straight down. The Martians were there. Timothy began to shiver. The Martians were there in the canal, reflected in the water. Timothy and Michael and Robert and Mom and Dad, the Martians stared back up at them for a long, long, silent time from the rippling water. More next week.